I'm Dick Gordon. Coming up, the story of a young progressive Muslim who's taking his message to the world through television. Moaz Masoud grew up in an Islamic household in Cairo, Egypt. He didn't really embrace the faith because, as he told me with a little bit of embarrassment, he was too busy early on trying to get high and get girls. He soon discovered that pursuing pleasure didn't much help him cope with the kinds of hurdles life was sending his way. So he went to a mosque, and he remembers having a spiritual encounter there that changed everything.
There was something happening. It was metaphysical, but something was happening in that room, in that mosque. And something's in my heart, and I can't explain it to anybody, let alone to myself, but I'm experiencing it. I remember just moving around saying, Allah is here.
Moaz now does his own religious broadcasting, determined to transform what he calls the angry face of Islam. That story, right after the news. Imagine you're sitting in a hotel room in Cairo. You're bored. CNN and BBC TV are not available, so you switch on what looks like another Arabic talk show, and you turn up the volume, and you get this.
May Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala open up our eyes and remove any oppression and any of these misconceptions in the name of Islam from the hearts of Muslims and the actions of both Muslim men and women, and allow us to enjoy our separate identities so that we complement and complete one another as opposed to have this competition. I mean, ultimately, if you truly empower a woman to truly be free and truly make her own choices, mm-hmm. that's the epitome of adl, of justice. Mm-hmm. Having, you know, but Melinda, you want to say something and I'll get back to this.
That what my grandma taught me, who was really a true feminist, mm-hmm. is that you don't have to be like a man to be equal to a man.
Exactly.
It turns out that this English language program is not piped in from elsewhere. It's local. Now, just hold on a minute. Such direct talk about gender equity in the city that prides itself as the intellectual heart of Islam? I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story.
The Story is produced by North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC. It's co-produced and distributed by American Public Media.
Let's go back once more to that TV talk show. It's called Stairway to Paradise. It was hosted by Moaz Masoud. Now, you tell me, based on what we know, does this sound like a show with people talking about Islam or something we might catch any afternoon on TV here in the U.S.?
Even though you may have a Harvard education, mm-hmm. you may be a lawyer, you may be successful, if you make the conscious decision to stay at home with your kids, you're looked down upon by society. Being a mom is a full-time job.
Isn't it?
It is.
And if you really knew the
effect... It's a double-time job.
It is a double-time job.
It's a 24/7 job.
It's a real... I mean, I don't work. I do work. Who the heck said I don't work? That's all I do. I want a vacation. You know what I mean?
Moaz Masoud is the first to admit that a Cairo-based program, which speaks so specifically about equality for women, was able to succeed and did not attract criticism because it was broadcast in English.
Fortunately, because most of the extremists are extreme enough to not want to learn English... I don't think they understood what I was saying, Dick, to be honest. But there was very negligible amounts of criticism. And yes, it was about like how a woman with her hair showing was on TV next to me. And, you know, my response was, I never said she was a nun. You know, the whole point is that she's here to talk about her story. I don't think I got any criticism about quoting from songs, etc., because I think predominantly the audience for that show was the Western Muslim audience, and they were totally fine with music if there's good meaning coming out.
And the kind of production that you would be putting together for that show, Parables in the Quran, or the second one, Stairway to Heaven, are there any kind of parallels here in the U.S. that would match that? I mean, if you say you're not preaching, then it's not televangelism. You're not trying to convert people or shame people. And yet it's kind of a talk show and kind of not a talk show. So it's not Oprah. It's not Phil Donahue.
Exactly. No, definitely not either. Yeah. I would say it's kind of like in the middle. You know, it's not really Oprah and it's not really televangelism either. I think that it's this semi-talk show, story sharing and telling type of show where we would, you know, relate to religion and cite religion a lot more.
Were you surprised at the kind of reaction you started to get?
You know, people are surprised at how I can have very comfortable conversations with atheists. And I actually do. I just genuinely feel that it's just a human being with a take on life. And it's just the way it is. He's not intimidating. You know, I'm not intimidated by the fact that he thinks that I believe in a fairy tale. You know what I mean? I'm interested. I want to see how he sees it, you know, how she sees it as a fairy tale. And I just hope that people can treat me the same way.
This past year, Moaz Masoud started broadcasting the same kind of program in Arabic, and he has developed a serious fan base. For example, when he speaks in public, hundreds of young men and women go to hear him talk about the kinds of problems they have and the way that Islam can help. While Moaz is not, strictly speaking, a televangelist, he has that kind of appeal as he talks about the human and compassionate side of Islam. Clips of Moaz are all over YouTube. Like so many people who have a message to preach, he also has a story. It's his own transformation from rich party boy in Cairo to a devotee of Islam. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. Here's how it happened. Moaz Masoud grew up in Kuwait and Cairo going to private schools. He says his plan was to date as many beautiful girls as possible.
I think I was more of the romantic type as well, where I kind of always, in spite of all this promiscuity, I'm looking for like this, the one, that type of thing. And, you know, there's a certain lifestyle that was kind of necessarily entailed, if you will, to achieve that popularity and to find the one. And it was kind of like what you can call the party lifestyle. Drinking or the drugs or just partying or picking a fight with some guy just to prove that you're strong. Or it did start out with like just maybe let's try this or just New Year's Eve or something. But eventually I remember ditching class regularly at the end of my high school years. I remember my grades going down from a 4.0 to like a 2.5. I remember, you know, experimenting with a lot more substance. I remember being less romantic and more just kind of lustful, you know, in my ways with regards to like the significant other. So it did definitely start going downhill.
And how serious did the drugs get?
It never got serious at all. I remember that I did have a wisdom in my approach. It was, you know, alcohol to me seemed to be a lot more body friendly. So I didn't really want to, you know, burn out any brain cells.
And how long did this go on, Moaz?
4 years would be its kind of peak period.
I don't know Cairo well enough to know if it's really easy to live that kind of life or was really easy to live that kind of life. Was anyone shaking a finger at you or were the police particularly hard on you or teachers or parents?
We were kind of like the outlaws, you know, this kind of group, the ones who spoke English and played the guitar and some of which would have, you know, earrings on or whatever and chains. And that entire scene was looked at, I think was very much frowned upon by the majority of society. I think that because not only did it represent a kind of deviation from ethics, but it was also an alien type of deviation.
And if I had caught you at a sober moment in those years and said, so are you Muslim? What? What would you have said?
I would have definitely said, yeah, absolutely, I'm Muslim. In fact, I remember a story, since you call the show The Story, of a friend of mine. His name is Islam. I don't know if you've come across, occasionally come across a Muslim whose name is Islam. We have that kind of thing. And this guy's name, Islam, and he was in one of those not-so-sober moments, right? And I remember this girlfriend of ours, her name was Patricia, and she tells us the story herself that they were just kind of partying one night, and she looks at him, and they're like dancing. She's like, Islam, you know, and they're going with the beat. Islam, isn't that like the name of a religion? Or your religion? And he looks at her, and he's like, God, and he gets like this guilt trip and leaves the party. So, yeah.
Were you guys at that time in any way kind of holding Islam at arm's length because you may not have liked the public way it was being expressed, the sort of stern face of Islam?
Absolutely, 100%. Myself and a lot of my good friends always had this problem with the kind of exclusivist nature that the modern extremist tends to have. You know, this feeling that only Muslims are saved and everything's haram, everything's prohibited. And that gave us the excuse to kind of postpone doing the things that we knew were still Islamic and needed to be done. You know, it was just an excuse. It's like, well, nobody's living it correctly anyway. The more ethical way to do things would be to say, well, let's start living it correctly. But since we also had these desires, it was a perfect scapegoat to just say that nobody understands Islam properly.
It's interesting the word that you use, postponing, because it implies that all of you, even at that time, knew you'd eventually come back to the mosque.
Absolutely. And I'm glad you picked that up from the word. That's exactly the state.
But that's very odd in a way to be, you know, living a life which is counter to much of what the religion says is the kind of life that you should live, almost as if it's a momentary, a sort of a period of escape before you are obliged to return.
I know. And that's funny because that's pretty much, for the most part, the state of most Muslims, particularly in this part of the world, in the Arab world. It's like almost like they push the button pause. And I was one of those people. This plan where, you know, I won't die before I'm 60, and therefore I'll unpause at 40 or something.
But that's more Hindu than it is Islamic, that, you know, whatever you do in the early part of life, you can fix it by atoning for it later on.
Well, it's definitely Hindu, but it's actually particularly Islamic. There's a very famous hadith, you know, hadith being a prophetic saying where the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, is reported to have said something, you know, إِنَّمَا الْأَعْمَالُ بِالْخَوَاتِيمِ, that deeds are actually, it's the last deed. And so if one is able to actually do one good deed at the end of their lives, that should kind of give you the atonement. The only trick is you never know when you're going to go.
You're listening to The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. Moez Masoud is joining us from Cairo and telling me about his path towards a spiritual life. It started when his college grades went down and his friends began to die.
It began to go really downhill. So my 4.0s now was at this point maybe a 2.7 or something, and I'm not really getting A's anymore. And my relationship with my mom is horrible. I subconsciously didn't like where I was going, because you could tell that I could have been a better person. And I didn't necessarily relate it to religion at all, right? So the solution wasn't to kind of check out Islam and maybe abide by its teachings, you know? That didn't seem to be the way. Until, I would say, the first thing that got me thinking was just death. I developed a kind of genuine fear of death. And the reason that happened was friends of mine were dying on me. One of them crashed his car. He passed away. His name was Esther. And then there was another one who died of blood cancer. And another one just crashed his car again. There's actually two more that crashed their cars, Saad and Kareem. I just kind of remember that year. It was really horrible. And then at one point, a friend of mine got into a car accident with his family, and the car kind of toppled over a few times. And they made it. Nobody died. Nobody got seriously hurt either. And I remember he just kind of had a hurt, kind of a lip injury, and he had to smoke his cigarette with like a long filter. And it was, he had a kind of a ponytail and like a shaved sides to his head, and he just cut off that ponytail and grew normal hair. And that was kind of his way of just becoming more Egyptian, and possibly, maybe in his interpretation, more Muslim. And he started praying, you know, the five prayers a day.
Yeah.
And he quit drinking. He would still come to bars with us and whatever, but he wouldn't drink. And it was, we used to call him Sheikh. You know the word Sheikh, meaning like kind of, the religious kind of figure. And the only reason we called him Sheikh is because he was praying and didn't drink.
You were teasing him, but he was still hanging out with you, right?
Yeah, because he knew we loved him, but it was just kind of like, come on, come back, you know? And, you know, it wasn't really just to come back because we want what we think is for your own good. It was more like, come back because you're giving us guilt trips, buddy, you know?
Moez Masoud was still not ready to let go of the party life. His own conversion came about when he'd gone to take a nap in the mosque, and he almost lost his temper with a noise made by a blind man who was also there. We'll talk about that and how it all led to Moez's transformation into an interpreter of Islam for young people in the Arabic world. I'm Dick Gordon from American Public Media. This is The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story. Weekend news from overseas brought us stories of suicide bombs in Israel and again in Baghdad. It's fair to say that Islamic militants use these kinds of bombs as weapons of war, but it's also fair to say that the people who are persuaded to blow themselves up are also convinced that it is an act of devotion to Islam. My guest today is at the extreme other end of this spectrum. Moez Masoud has become a revered spiritual guide for many young Muslims because he is not preaching that hellfire and hatred version of the religion. But as Moez was explaining to me a couple of minutes ago, it took him some time before he found religion. He was living the life of a Cairo frat boy when his friends started to die, and then he discovered he had a tumor on his spleen.
And the way we discovered that was I was in the middle of a basketball game and I got incredible pain in my left side of my stomach. And I just didn't know what that was. We did a CAT scan. It turns out there's a tumor and we must operate immediately. And to me, it was like, whoa, now that same ghost that's been kind of chasing all my friends is coming my way.
Moez went ahead and had the surgery.
And I remember that they had to cut me open in the middle and move away my ab muscles, my abdomen muscles, and then go inside, do their thing. So I wake up and the injury is like in the wrong place, in my understanding. I'm like, what the heck happened here? These Egyptian doctors, you know, whatever. He was like the best guy in the Middle East, you know? And it turns out that they explained it to me. No, you know, we cut you open here because of da 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 yada. And the other effect of moving away your ab muscles is that you can't laugh. Because if you laugh, you faint because of the pain. And so my friends were visiting me. I remember a faint memory of the entire two-day process where they were all visiting me. People would come in. Hey, how are you doing? So one would say a joke. I would faint. Wake up. See a whole new lot of people. I'm like, don't nobody say anything funny, you know? And someone would say something funny, and then it just kept on going that way. And for 4 whole days, I wasn't allowed to kind of eat or drink anything. You know, I just remember just dreaming about like a drop of water, you know, for 4 whole days just coming into my mouth. And that was the beginning of my kind of search for God, because I realized that I had been taking certain things for granted. And really, that was the beginning of this spiritual discovery for me. That point, that surgery took me somewhere else.
After that, Moaz Masoud decided to clean up his act, to square things with his mother, to improve his grades, and to stop drinking. Well, it didn't last very long. New Year's Eve, 1995, was just 2 weeks away.
'Tis the season to be sinful, you know, if one can put it that way. And it's just like, if only I could just push pause on God one more time. And then I, you know, really, and it felt horrible because part of me was dying to go to that like party and just, you know, find that girl again in just that one moment. But part of me knew that that was the ongoing thing about life, that this was the decision I had to make. And to sit there and say, now, am I going to do what I want? Or am I going to do what I believe and what I know you want?
So who won the contest on New Year's Eve? Was it the good angel or the bad angel?
The bad angel, unfortunately. I was so weak, you know. And so I went to the party. It was, you know, the countdown obviously is the best experience. You just, whichever chick you see, it's time to hug. Now 9, 8, 7, 6, you know, 5, 4, 3, 2, yay. But then, of course, we had like a headbanging session on like Nirvana or something, and we beat each other up, and there was blood, and it was just kind of like a horrible mess again. And I realized that, you know, it's one of those short-lived things again, that you give away truth, you know, what you believe to be truth. You give it up for something you know is wrong, but now I also realize you know is short-lived. And in the short ride back, we almost crashed the car. And I remember just like, you know, the brakes just right before hitting into a truck.
Were you sober enough to know how close you'd come?
Oh, yeah, 100%. No, I was almost fully sober. I didn't really get on that much that night. It was just barely just go there and have a small drink, you know, and that kind of thing. I just remember driving him home and just thinking, it's like I didn't really hear a voice per se, but deep down I kind of heard like, this is your last chance. I went to sleep at 8 a.m. and I got up at about like 7 p.m. or something, you know, just in a hangover, and there was no one at home. And I just kind of stopped, and everything stopped. You know, time froze. And I knew the higher being was there. I had no doubts about that. I didn't know exactly what that meant. You know, what kind of life am I supposed to lead? But I knew that there were certain things that had to be fixed up. And I just did something really funny that, in Arabic movies, whenever some like guy wants to repent, he puts his hand on like the holy book. And I felt that that was kind of a physical proof, you know, it was physical proof that I'm going back. And so I put my hand on the holy Quran and I kind of said, God, I know you hear me, and I know I've been bad, and I know that, et cetera, et cetera. And it was a moment for me, and it was really a timeless moment. And I just kind of said, that's it. You know, I don't know what I'm going to be exactly, but I'm going to change. Something's going to change. It wasn't even go to mosque type thing. It was just, I was very realistic in my approach. I remember saying that I'll quit alcohol, for example, but I'll still smoke cigarettes. I won't scream at my mom, you know, or just get into fights with my little sister. I'll try to get my grades up again because I just want my mom to be happy. She's paying all this tuition, you know, and doing all these things. I had lost a lot of weight with the surgery, and I kind of thought that I wanted to get back in shape and work out and just kind of look good again, etc., you know, all these kinds of things. And I remember saying that I'm not sure if I'm going to be able to pray all 5 prayers on time every day because I forget. But I made a pact that I wouldn't go to sleep without finishing the 5, even if it meant lumping them all up together. And then once I agreed to the doses, I said, now God, if I fail to do these things, just take my life. That's it. You know, you gave me a chance to live again. Here I am back out of the surgery. And if I fail to do these things, just take me. And for me, it was like a moment of gratitude. I just felt that the proof that I'm grateful for life is that I'm going to do things that I might not necessarily feel like doing these days, like those prayers at night or whatever. And I'm going to stop doing things that had you, that higher power, truth, beauty, and justice, you know, this God, this deity, had you not been there, there's nothing else that would have made me stop doing these things, you know. It's almost like I was saying, I'm going to give up a part of me. And it's going to hurt me. And you know, that's the feeling I had that day. I'm going to be in pain. And it's going to be very hard. But I just believe. I believe that this is the way it should be. And I know that it will be made easy eventually.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. My guest is the popular Cairo television personality, Moez Masoud. He told me that Muslims cannot be born again in the same way that Christians can. But after a couple of years, toying with the idea of a renewed commitment to Islam, Moez had a very similar experience.
Do you remember that song, Until I Met a Blind Man Who Taught Me How to See, like Aerosmith?
Yeah.
Well, that's what happened to me. I met a blind man who taught me how to see. And no, really. What happened was, you know, we would have gaps in between classes and sometimes three-hour gaps. I had begun to slowly pray. Didn't really go to mosque per se, but when you're in college and it's time to pray, there's no other place to go but the mosque. You can't pray at home. So, you know, I'd go up and pray sometimes. And I remember just wanting to rest for a few minutes. And there was only one other person in the mosque. And it was this young man, my same age, who was just kind of fiddling and fidgeting around with like a whole bunch of cassette tapes, making a whole bunch of noise. And I still had that anger in me. I had started working out, got a little buff and stuff, you know, thought that that was the one sin that wasn't physically apparent, just this whole arrogance and toughness,
right,
and prove yourself. So I'm not drinking, but I'm also walking around like a bodyguard in the bar, you know. So here's this guy, and I'm thinking, I'm going to go give him a piece of my mind, you know. I'm just going to go, you shut up here, you know, I'm trying to sleep. And I realized that he's blind. What turns out that he doesn't see me as I'm talking to him, you know, he's not looking in my direction. And I ask him what happened. It turns out it's a genetic form of blindness. So I'm thinking, why did God do that to him? You know, why did that power do that? And he starts talking to me, and very sincerely, and you can tell in the tone of voice, you can just feel something, that he's real. And he starts telling me that, no, see, that higher being, that God, did this to me because it loves me and because it's chosen me. And I'm like, what the heck? What kind of Greek gibberish is this? You know, you're blind, you know. And he's like, no, see, but my heart can see. And as he was saying these things, I was making these realizations. There was something happening. It was metaphysical, but something was happening in that room, in that mosque. And just right when he leaves, something's in my heart now. I remember just moving around saying, Allah is here.
That blind student, Mahmoud, became very important in Moez Masoud's life, particularly in Moez's own search for spirituality.
I remember he had a very angelic kind of recital voice, like when he read the Quran to me. The way he sincerely, but also outwardly, beautifully recited the Quran appealed to my musical ear. And that was kind of my gateway. It was just like, wow, you know. And my heart started to taste, you know, spiritually taste and experience meanings, a meaning of gratitude. That theoretical deity that I believed in, you know, knew was there, suddenly became personal. And I got high. You know, I'd stopped getting high physically, but I got high. And I was afraid to sleep because I was afraid to wake up and it would go.
Are you telling people about this, Moez, at this point?
At this point I am, because I was fascinated. Not many people. It wasn't like a kind of a preachy type effort, but my close friends. I remember once I ran down to the basketball court and I'm like, we don't thank Allah. I just went crazy for a minute. We're like, what the heck's wrong with him? You know, another born again.
Were even your close friends sort of going, what is wrong with you?
They did. And then, but one by one, a lot of them were actually beginning to just taste as well. I remember that a particular one of them actually had his own experience maybe 2 or 3 months later. But again, some of them didn't. And I didn't really care. It wasn't about converting people. It was just about, since you're my friend, I may as well tell you what just, you know, the experience I just had, and, you know, you decide for yourself. Now, that's when I started, quote unquote, going to mosque. Because I had that high, when I would hear the call for prayer, I knew that it was calling me.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. Moez Masoud grew up speaking English and colloquial Arabic, which is very different from the formal Arabic, which is the language of the Quran. He spent the next year studying and reading and listening.
And unbeknownst to me, all of a sudden, a year and a half later, I knew the entire Quran by heart.
You mean so you could recite it?
Yeah, I had it all memorized. I didn't even mean to. It was accidental. I was just listening so much, so deeply, so involved, so intensely, trying to figure out what that being wanted to say to me. And it was so weird because I just don't think it was normal, you know, to just kind of memorize 640 pages or so accidentally. But yeah, I remember the day I learned that was accidental again. We were at the mosque in Ramadan. They just had this contest of like, who knew more Quran? And I would just sit and listen to the people thinking, oh, lucky them. And I realized everything they were saying I could say. And I went back home and I tried it out. And it was like, I knew the whole book.
What did your family think about this new incarnation of yourself?
My mother in particular had this fear of, you know, me turning terrorist or something, you know, because there is a tendency in today's world, and I don't want to magnify it. It's not as big as some media may want to make it seem, but nonetheless, there is a tendency to just possibly go extreme, particularly at that age. And so she was really worried, and especially I think those years, there was more of this whole terrorists used to secretly get together in mosques and plan these homemade bombs and stuff, and it's horrible.
Did you guys talk about this? Did she ask you?
Oh yeah, absolutely. And I would just be like, Mom, you're crazy, you know, I'm just getting high on God, you know, I'm not doing anything else. She's like, I know, but you just don't go there, just pray. I'm like, no, Mom, it's better to pray in the mosque. You know, we had these arguments all the time. Many times I'd be like, Mom, I'm going past Nadi Gezira, you know, the sports club. And I would drive by it just so I don't lie, and then I would go to the mosque next to it. And we went through that for a while, yeah.
That's a little bit of a reverse. don't worry, Mom. I'm just going to work out, and you end up at the mosque. I mean, was she, if you've talked about it since that time, was she watching for you growing a beard, you changing your dress, you becoming more strident? How worried was she?
Exactly what you just said. Those were the three concerns she had: beard, dress, and strident.
Can I ask you, though, if that was ever a door that was open to you?
Absolutely not. And you know, the good thing about having been brought up in a liberal education was just that I was too smart for these things. You know, and it just didn't make sense. You know, you don't fight evil with evil, even if you think that a certain, you know, first of all, I couldn't make generalizations. I couldn't hate Americans because of American policy, for example, like a lot of people do today. You know, they'll hate all Americans because of a finite, you know, 4 to 8 year American government or administration. I couldn't make these generalizations because of the logic that I had been taught, but also because I, for example, to use Americans as an example again, I had American teachers all my life, so I had to humanize, they were very human to me. I just kind of saw through all that all the time. In fact, I remember that there were different people, not necessarily the violent type, but again, the kind of groups in the middle were the very political faces of Muslim revivalist groups, and a lot of them did speak to me about like my views and joining the bandwagon and all these types of things. I just always saw through it and said, no, I think Islam is just very different from what you think it is.
You're listening to The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. Moez Masoud was developing quite a reputation as a young interpreter of Islam. His transformation into TV talk show host happened, of all places, in Rochester, New York. A year before 9/11, he was invited to speak there. And a number of people who heard him made tapes of his talks, and so he developed such a bootleg appeal that TV producers, back in Egypt, asked him to host an English-language television show, and what they got was not what even they expected.
I did what I wanted. I remember that, you know, they said, hey, you should wear a suit. I'm like, no, I'm going to wear just regular clothes. Okay, wear regular clothes. Hey, you should sit on a chair and have like a 100-person audience in the back. I'm like, no, I'm going to have 6 people, 3 boys and 3 girls, or 4 boys and 4 girls, and we're just going to sit and talk in a circle together. Okay, fine, do that. Hey, why don't you talk about these things? No, you know, and they would just give suggestions, but I did what I wanted in the end, and it was kind of like, I called it parables in the Quran. And I just chose certain parables and metaphors and stories from the Quran, like the story of Joseph, for example, and different stories where I would just bring out the moral from the story, but in language that we as youth could understand, you know, just talk about, you know, Metallica lyrics or something, or Dylan or whatever, and just so we can all relate to it.
How do you link up Metallica lyrics and a parable from the Quran and the story that some 14-year-old boy or girl watching TV is going to be caught up in? How'd you do? What were you doing?
Well, for example, James Hetfield sang about his mother, Mama Said, a song, and I remember that he talked about how he ran away from home. Rebel, my new last name.
Rebel, my new last name. Wild blood in my veins. Apron strings around my neck. The mark that still remains.
Apron strings around my neck, you know, the mark, it still remains. wild blood in my veins, all these lyrics. And until eventually he comes back home, and he says, I left home at an early age. And he comes back home and tells his mother that never I asked of you, but never I gave, but you gave me your emptiness, and like that. And then he says, Mama, now I'm coming home. I need your arms to welcome me, but a cold stone is all I see. And she's dead. And that really moved me, and I just thought that there was nothing wrong at all telling the story that way. Actually showed me a video of a young man telling the media how an episode of mine changed his life, and I've never even met him. He just said that when Mu'izz said, Mama said, and quoted from that song, I remember that it really hit me, and I went to my mother, he says, and we had had a horrible relationship, and I told her that from now on things would be different, and things remained different.
The real change for Mu'izz Masood came last year when he decided he was ready to do a similar kind of show in Arabic. If he was ever going to be challenged for being too Western or too liberal, this was the moment. More on that up next. I'm Dick Gordon from American Public Media. This is The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story. My guest is Mu'izz Masood. He hosts an Arabic television show in Cairo, offering what one newspaper account calls a kind of sweet orthodoxy, an interpretation of the Quran, and a spiritual guide to Islam that sounds a whole lot different to what we're used to hearing. For example, he recently took on a conversation about homosexuality. And now, it doesn't sound overly progressive in U.S. terms. Homosexuality, he says, is a sin.
The act, yes, is absolutely forbidden, and there's no compromise there, but how are you dealing with the person who has same-sex attraction? You know, what are you doing about it? How would you treat someone? Everybody's like, it's taboo, we run away from it. I'm like, yeah, really? Well, it's growing. What are you going to do? And we tackled that.
So what did you say? What was your suggestion?
Hate the sin, not the sinner. You know, in this very, very simple Islamic formula. We have a problem with the act itself because we believe that it's metaphysically a crime, not just physically. However, you know, a human being is a human being, and if they're, especially if they feel that these feelings are besides themselves, you know, if they're getting them unintentionally, it's not like, hey, let's go and just check out that gay bar. You know, it's not like that. And so I was trying to humanize the people who were going through what I would call that same-sex struggle.
So what in fact you were saying is it's okay to condemn the act, but be a little bit tolerant of people who are homosexual? Or be a lot tolerant? Or
no, I actually took it further. I said, you must condemn the act, but you must fully tolerate the person.
Can you have it both ways?
Absolutely. That's been the story of my life. You know, because you're not going to do anything. When you condemn the act, you're not like going to pass a law or anything. I'm just saying that in your heart, you must believe that that act is not Islamically acceptable. But nonetheless, that should not reflect in any way, shape, or form on how you deal with the person. I co-wrote the theme song for my show, and I actually wrote its music as well. It's called the Tariq al-Sah, the right path or the right way, or however way you want to translate that. And there was a part which was, أي وكره أي غلط وما تكرهش الغلطان كان ممكن تبقى أنت مكان وتكون في التوبة طمعان, in colloquial Arabic. Yes, you should hate every sin, but never should you hate the sinner, the person sinning. For you could have been in their shoes, hoping for a way back.
Mu'izz Masood took a big step this past year when he started this kind of TV talk show in Arabic. See, no longer was this a broadcast available only to the elite. Now everyone could watch it.
سامحني كان لازم أجيلك من زمان أبكي بندم وأتمنى تغفر للي كان
رفعت ايدي للسماء قربت لك تاني ازاي نسيت ربنا.
The Arabic program is called The Right Way. Moaz Masoud says that when he started the broadcast, he did get some criticism from fundamentalists, but he also got a tremendous response from young Arab kids who found in him a voice they could relate to.
I began realizing that the Arab world, the youth in the Arab world, were beginning to have the same problems now. That this generation of youth is different from the one right before, which is the one that I was. You know, I'm about 29 right now, and I'm talking about like 16-year-olds. They're a lot more westernized, which in some ways is very good, but in other ways, there's certain aspects to modern or postmodern Western culture that are just not compatible with spirituality in general and Islam in particular. And I just saw that all of the movements that were trying to bring the Arab world back together didn't seem to know what they were saying. Whether they were the secular movements, which just kind of put religion on the shelf, and that doesn't work with Arabs. It just doesn't work. It wasn't working. And then you had all of these twisted forms of Islamic revival attempts. You know, you had the very extreme form, sometimes as extreme as to go to violence, and that's obviously out of the question and un-Islamic, but also just extreme in views, just this whole thing of society's all evil except me and my sheikh and maybe two of my friends. That doesn't work either. And then you had the other extreme, which was the kind of air-conditioned Islam, where it was trying to adapt so much to the modern world that it lost the core, the heart of Islam, the love. It wasn't there. So you almost had this like perfectly put together outward embodiment of Islam, but it just wasn't lasting. People were trying it for a year or two, and then they were falling out.
How much of a high wire move was this for you, though, to start taking these subjects and start broadcasting about them in Arabic? Because all of a sudden you don't have that elite, upper-class, English language-speaking class of young people watching you, but you're talking to everyone in the Arab world.
Exactly. It was a difficult decision. The reason I felt it was difficult was I didn't know how ready the Arab world was for the real traditional message of Islam. You know, are they ready to hear that what Gandhi did was quintessentially Islamic? That was what the Prophet Muhammad, sallallahu alaihi wasallam, peace be upon him, did while he was in Mecca, this whole non-violent, non-cooperation, you know, and that might be what, for example, you guys need to do in Palestine. Do you know what I mean? Could they handle that? Or it'd be like, no, he's a traitor, he's an American bred fellow who just is getting a payroll from the White House, you know?
Yeah.
And so that's why it was difficult, because I didn't want to say these words when it wasn't time. Fortunately, I realized that it was time.
But what about people who would call you a traitor? Has that happened?
I remember getting one comment on the website forum where I was the cross-wearing polytheist crusader preacher. And it's just like, you know, okay. Like cross-wearing. You can see how much he loves Christians, you know. That cross-wearing, almost like, so what? You know, what's wrong with the cross? It's the beautiful symbol of the meeting place, you know, where heaven meets earth, where vertical meets horizontal. Right. I love the cross. You know, I can see millions of meanings in the cross, but no, you're a cross-wearing, you know.
Have you figured out why it is that what you want to talk about, helping kids, you know, relate simple dilemmas that they face in their lives, helping them connect that to their religion, why this is such a novel thing?
I think the novelty is in the approach. I think that everyone who speaks in the name of religion is trying to do, theoretically at least, trying to do the same thing, right? But I think it's all about how you do it. I always highlight the fact that your struggle itself is holy, you know, struggle with yourself, and that you are getting reward just for even feeling bad while you're drinking, for example, or whatever it is. And I also think that my traditional upbringing with scholars of tradition has just given authenticity to my tone of voice, you know, the message.
Yeah.
I've been, for the past 6 years, I've been around shuyukh, spiritual guides, who are just real. You know, I remember being with one man whom had just given a talk to like 40,000 people, 20,000 of whom mobbed our car, right? Not on purpose, but just trying to say hi, you know? And I remember how as soon as we got into the car, the door is shut and he's like, if only they knew my real state or something. And I'm like, wow, you're not thinking, wow, I'm Brad Pitt or something? Is, you know, you're not. And it was real, because you could tell, you know, you could tell when someone's be like, no, I'm not. And you could tell that he's enjoying it. And you could tell when someone really sees it as just a test. and just people who are real. And I don't claim, I don't make any claim to being real, but I can guarantee you that I try my best to be real.
I'm still not clear on why you think this is a good time to try and make this television appeal to young kids. Is there something going on now where you have the opportunity to do that and you're not seen to be threatening a more traditional structure of Islam?
Yeah, I think two things. The answer is twofold. First of all, every time is a good time for the real interpretation of faith, in my opinion, of course. But also, more specifically, yes, I think the people have given up on the air-conditioned brand and also on the starve yourself to death, the whole extremism. I think that they're both not working. And I think that maybe, you know, 10 years ago, those were still trying and they were still possibly going to be believed. I think that by their fruits you shall know them. And we've seen a lot of the young girls who donned head garments and took them back off. You know, we've seen all those different scenes. And we've seen the young men who did the violence and then said, no, we shouldn't have. And I think those have become cliches now.
Yeah, maybe, except that I still hear leaders in the Arab world saying to leaders in the Western world, you should be careful. You should watch your own backyard. There are militant forms of Islam in France and in Britain and in the United States which are being fed by a kind of, what's the anti-Muslim version of anti-Semitism? I don't know what the proper word
no, no,
is.
No, it's beautifully put.
That are being fed by a kind of hatred between religions. Mm-hmm. Do you believe that's not the case?
No, I believe that still exists. But I also believe that there can be a time where, while it exists, people are ready for something else. And when I say people, I mean the majority. I think that these different things you mentioned exist, but are a minority, in my opinion, of course. And I think that the majority of people are ready to listen.
Moaz, thanks for your time.
Thank you for your time.
Moaz Masoud joined me from Cairo. You can read more about him and his broadcasts on our website at thestory.org. I took a course in hallelujah. I went to night school for deep blues. Well, I took some stuff they said were cool, yeah. But nothing seemed to light my fuse. But it's all in the past, like the check that's in the mail. She was a tall whiskey glass. I was an old hound dog that just loved to chase his tail. You know, if you want to have the web take you even further into this kind of alternative voice of Islam, take advantage of the search engine that's built into the YouTube site, and you'll see just how often Moaz Masoud is downloaded and viewed. You also know that the program, The Story, is always on the lookout for people who have this kind of personal experience or moments of transformation like Moaz. These stories help us all make better sense of what's going on around us. If you have a story to share or a suggestion of one, someone we should contact, you can get to me easily through our website at thestory.org or simply leave me a message at our telephone, 1-888-966-9862. It's been about 6 weeks since we last heard from our man in Baghdad. Despite two fearsome suicide bombs in the Iraqi capital this past Friday, Ahmed Abdullah says there is a greater sense of safety on the streets, and that's led people to concentrate on other essential pursuits. This is the latest edition of Ahmed's diary.
It has been a long time since I last wrote. I was thinking that every time I write, it is something about death. But this time it's different, because it is true. Security is getting better every day. But there are other things that I must talk about now, because security is not the only thing a man wants. We might have better security now, but there are no jobs. And believe me, this is a big problem. It goes like this. If you want a government job, you must belong to one of the political parties operating here. And of course, if you want a good job, then you must be a member in one of the big and important parties. I know that this is also true in the US, that the party in power gives jobs to people, but it is much more dangerous here in Iraq. The trouble is this. If you join a party in order to get a new job, someone might decide that you are a traitor and you will be killed. But if you don't join a party and wanted to get promoted, then you can be in trouble too. My uncle knows the man who was just hired as the dean of the dental school in Baghdad. His name was Munzer Mehraj. He got his new job 1 week ago. When he was driving back home from work, a car pulled beside him and men shot him and killed him. Munzer did not belong to any party. I guess the killers thought that he was doing a bad thing, teaching dentists. My uncle tells me that anyone who gets a good job and who's not in the right party can be killed. The other place a man can go in Iraq to look for a job is to one of the Western companies operating here. But that's the worst kind of place, because he will almost certainly be called a spy and get killed. This has happened to many people I know. So what other choice does a man have? Maybe to open a shop? But you would need a lot of money. Even if he can do this, there are gangsters who can kidnap him or one of his family members. My brother Ali has not worked in over a year. He stays home all day. When the power is on, he watches TV. He once belonged to the ruling Ba'ath party, so he cannot work at all. They say that the rules are changing, but Ali is afraid to put his name in for any job. Afraid that people will see he was in the Ba'ath party and then track him down and kill him. He can't work for the government because now he's not a member of any party. He used to drive his car as a taxi and now it is broken. So what can he do? He lives with me, so do his kids and his wife. And I tried to help them, but he is embarrassed to take money from me, so I have to give him the money when no one is watching. Here's my question. What about the rest of all the Alis like him in Iraq? What can they do? Freedom and democracy do not feed people. So when will the leaders stop saying that they care about our lives and our dignity? The way I see it, this security they are so proud of achieving will not hold for long, because the people who are willing to pay are the terrorists. $500 to do a job is a lot of money to a man who cannot feed his family. My brother Ali won't be tempted by this, but many people will. Then we start all over again.
Ahmed Abdullah lives in Baghdad. He keeps an audio diary for the story. In fact, we have all of Ahmed's diary entries archived on our website at thestory.org. Have a listen. Let me know what you think. And also, if you have a story to suggest, you can write to me at The Story, 120 Friday Center Drive, Chapel Hill, North Carolina. That's 120 Friday Center Drive, Chapel Hill, North Carolina. The zip code is 27517. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story. Thank you.
The Story is a production of North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill.
American Public Media.